Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. I'm a big fan of the book. I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it also made it into the VMA's gift bag, and you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book by going to Amazon, or you can go to Cliffside's website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Get the book. Get it now. I recommend it. Hi there. It's Anna David with After Party Pod. Oh my God. My guest today is so outstanding. You will soon hear that, but she's also been an incredible influence in my life. We discuss it at length, but she's the woman who got me to quit smoking, and quite what a big deal that is. It's hard to actually explain how dedicated I was to the art of smoking. I saw it as an art, actually. And from the time I was 12 years old, and I remember driving, no, I wasn't driving at 12, but I smoked first at 12 at a David Bowie concert, which was my first concert. And I mentioned that because people often ask, what was your first concert? And I always feel super cool that I can say David Bowie, even though I had no idea who that person was, and it was just, you know, my friend got tickets and her mom took us. And the first concert that I loved is so much more embarrassing and accurate, and that was Thompson Twins, and I cried and wept like a Beatles fan or something. You know, I mean, like real crazy crying because I was so moved by Hold Me Now. But anyway, at the David Bowie concert, I smoked my first cigarette, and then I remember when I got my license, thinking I was so cool driving and smoking, and thinking, one day I'm going to be a real smoker. I had that thought. That day came sooner, I think, than I'd anticipated. By the time I was a sophomore in college, I was a chain smoker, and I kept that up for a long time. And then when I was 9 months sober, I met this lady, and this lady dared to confront me about my smoking. And unlike all the other people that had confronted me about my smoking, because I seemed to get lectures all the time, I think that if you live in California and you smoke, that even the people selling me cigarettes would lecture me. Why do you smoke? Anyway, there was something about the way this woman talked to me, and there was something about this woman that caused me to never smoke again. And that was, it was July 19th was my date. It was July 19th, 2001. So it's been a long time. And so, and she really took me under her wing. She had been sober a long time when I first got sober, and I was so flattered that this super uber fabulous woman had took this interest in me, and it was amazing. And over the years, so when I first met her, she told me, I really want to write a book. She's been this fabulous hairdresser for years, and she, before she bottomed out in her addiction, have I even told you her name? This is so irresponsible of me. I guess I'm heightening the anticipation. Well, her name is Carrie White, and that is also the name of Carrie in the movie Carrie, but that has nothing to do with this Carrie White. She grew up in LA and outside of LA, and she became this huge hairdresser and was doing Elvis's hair and Anne Margaret and everybody, and she was doing it on roller skates, and she was that woman. She also married three times, and she has five kids now. And then she really bottomed out in her addiction and lost it all and came back. And now, by the time I met her, you know, was in the process of opening her own salon again. And she now, it's in Beverly Hills. It's super fabulous. And she got all the celebrities back. And then this book that she really wanted to write, she wrote it. It came out last year, and it became a Los Angeles Times bestseller. And she's just an amazing spirit and an amazing woman, and she's 29 years sober. And what else can I say about Carrie White? I mean, listen to the interview, and you'll fall for her the same way I did. As I often tell her, she put a spell on me. because you couldn't get me to quit smoking without putting a spell on me. So hopefully she'll put a spell on you. This is Carrie White. Here I go reporting us. Carrie White.
Hello.
Hi. So, okay, we were just talking about how when we first met, and I just thought you were the coolest woman I'd ever met because you were dating somebody who was younger than me. This adorable, would know. You're giving me a look like...
No. That's all I did. I never checked my driver's license. I was as old as whoever I was looking at. That was called the 90s.
But isn't that still the 2013s?
Well, you know, it happens.
Well, so, okay, so the famous story when we met, and it's famous only because I tell it constantly.
Oh, dear.
And have written about it. Is
And okay, have written about
I
it.
I have.
Oh.
Okay, so it's about you putting a spell on me. So.
Oh, yeah.
I was 9 months sober.
Uh-huh.
And I went to dinner with a friend and two women I did not know, you being one of them. And we were at Ivy by the Shore because we're super fabulous.
Yes.
And I did what I always did during dinner, which is that I got up like 3 or 4 times to go outside to smoke a cigarette because you couldn't smoke in restaurants then.
Right.
Even then. And earlier that night, I had accidentally, I'd been smoking and my cigarette had hit some woman's like shawl. I don't know if you remember this part. And you just looked at me so plainly and you said to me, "You know, honey, I don't know why you're doing that. You know, you burned that woman's clothing. And, you know, you're really putting a smokescreen between you and God." And I looked at you, and all, you know, I had sort of gotten, I'd been smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day for 13 years. And so I had gotten little lectures from people. You know, every time I bought cigarettes, they'd go, "Why do you smoke?" And I was so used to sort of wanting to punch people. And I just looked at you and I said, "What?" And you said, "Well, getting sober and continuing to smoke is like switching seats in the Titanic. Why would you do that?" And I was like, "What?" And you kept saying a couple things. And then you said the key thing, which was that a guy I had a crush on went to the 12-step program for people quitting smoking. And that the meeting was the next day and that you would meet me there. And I thought, you know, who is this lady? As I drove home smoking cigarettes, I went to work the next day. I smoked. And halfway through the day, I decided I was going to go meet you at that meeting. And I never smoked again.
Isn't that exciting?
Isn't that crazy?
It's such a paradigm shift. You know, you can hear one sentence.
Yeah.
The power of the word, huh?
But it was you, too. I mean, you said it in this just non-judgmental way that was so, and you had, you know, your joy for life and your sort of zest for recovery has always been so inspiring, but you put it around cigarettes for me then, and it changed my life. I mean, I had tried to quit
it before. Does quitting smoking changes your life?
But I, you don't understand that I did not think I was capable of that. I thought,
who does? It's so attached to our breath. Every time we breathe, we suck in that poison, and that addiction is kept alive. But here's the trick. It's like, why are we suffocating ourselves? Don't we want to live? Don't we come to these programs to recover? Why would we not want to live and then continue to commit suicide on a moment-to-moment basis?
Yeah.
Don't they pull people out of buildings for smoke inhalation?
Right.
Okay.
I just, you know, it was like the denial, you know, I think it was like when the last layer of the rules don't apply to me. Well, not really, because I still think the rules don't apply in certain ways. But like to continue to smoke, you have to believe that the rules don't apply to you. Because if they did, you'd know you'd die a horrible death.
Well, you also haven't spiritually arrived to have enough self-love to see that you're hurting yourself.
Yeah.
This is not a moral issue.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
This is about there's nothing in your body that isn't getting hurt from this action.
Right.
You cannot smoke and think it doesn't hurt you.
Right.
It's not okay. Not because it's a moral issue or it's stinky or your teeth get yellow or somebody doesn't like it that doesn't smoke. You are hurting your circulatory system. You are hurting your heart. You are hurting your lungs. You're hurting your skin.
Right.
You're hurting the cuticles of your toenails, your eyelashes.
Right.
It is destructive. And it is the last really obvious destructive thing that we are ingesting.
Yeah.
I mean, there is sugar, there's things you can break down, but those things in moderation can be dealt with. There's not one hit off a cigarette that we don't know isn't producing a cancer cell.
Right. Yeah, it was like somehow you had the ability to break my denial down. And it was just the craziest thing. So I went to that. I went to the meeting. I met you, the guy I had the crush on. I actually still remember who it was, although like the crush disappeared. Well, okay. So then after the meeting, he and I went to coffee. So I didn't smoke from, let's say, 3 o'clock that afternoon. And then I got to the meeting and I thought, well, maybe I'll just try not smoking the rest of the night. Who knows, you know? And I went to coffee with him where he told me that he'd had an affair with his cousin.
What?
I was immediately over my crush on him, but it got me through that first night. And I went home and I was like, okay, maybe I just won't smoke. And then the next day I sort of thought, this is a lark. I'm going to try this again. And I did that.
This is a lark. That used to be a name of a cigarette, I think, larks. I don't know.
But then I did that until I met you probably at the next meeting. And then I quit. And the first 3 weeks were the worst hell I'd ever experienced in my life. And from once that ended, I said, oh my God, if I'd known how easy this was going to be, I would have done it years ago.
Yeah.
You know? But so that's how we met.
Let me interject this though. Isn't it interesting? We can clearly see evolution as we look at social practices of consciousness.
Right.
Where before, you know, just smoking is in every single film you see. Right. Everybody is like they've got a fork in one hand and a cigarette in another. So we do evolve. Consciousness does evolve.
Yeah. I mean, and we've seen smoking, the awareness around that, evolve in 10 years. I mean, a very short period of time.
I used to have a cigarette in my mouth when I went into the vegetable department in the market to go, get a salad for my family.
I remember smoking in a movie theater.
Of course.
I remember
airplanes.
Airplanes,
of course.
But yeah, there was this thing. I mean, there was, I think, the fact that, smoking going hand in hand with drug addiction and alcoholism is sort of this, I aspired to be, well, first of all, I didn't value my life. I didn't value my life at all. But I thought it was cool. Like, I thought not valuing my life was cool.
Do you know, my bottom of my addiction, I didn't think that I had a good night unless I had knotted out and burned my fingers with a cigarette. That's my bottom with smoking. Not that I quit smoking at that point, but I'm saying that's how it carried and stayed with me. It was still like such a...
Well, and I remember because I used to take like 10 Ambien a night. I remember that I'd get on my couch, I take the 10 Ambien, and I, the best thing about
10?
Yeah, the best thing about Ambien.
Is it called Ambien 10, or you took 10 of them?
I took 10 of them. I built up to, because I was supposed to be cutting them in quarters, and mm-hmm. I was taking 10. And when you take that much Ambien, you will get knocked out, like, when the what's the guy who counts you out and says count 10?
Yeah, anesthesiologist.
Yeah. And I would be smoking, and I'd go, I put the cigarette out before this happens. Like, that's what I would do.
The insanity.
I know.
It's insane to smoke. It's insane to suffocate ourselves. Well, nobody thinks. And if you'll notice, people who smoke, they even hold the cigarette away from their visual, off to the side. Mm. They blow off to the side of their mouth. Like, smoking? Who's smoking? I don't see anybody smoking.
Right.
It's like, there's a part of you that, tries to,
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I get rid of it.
Mm.
Oh, dancing. I mean, I hate it. I go to the club and somebody's, on the dance floor smoking. Talk about you burn that lady's shawl. How many times I got burned in the 80s at the Pink? Somebody with their cigarette, I'd be so annoyed. It's like...
Okay, so let's go through the life of Carrie White.
Oh my God!
Not with every detail.
Is this going to be a documentary that will run 3.5 hours in the theater?
Series, it's 12 hours. That's just part one.
This is a week show, right? For a week.
No, we're gonna do highlights. See,
of my Hollywood life.
Okay, so
wait, hello.
Do you think I didn't know that? So one of the first things you said to me, besides, you know, you're putting a smoke screen between you and God, is I'm writing a memoir.
Yes. Well, I didn't even think,
I didn't even
know that word.
Yeah. You said I'm writing something?
I'm writing a book.
I'm writing a book, you said.
Yeah.
And...
I may have used that old-fashioned term, autobiography. What's the difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
There's no difference.
One's French and one's English.
I mean, there's no difference. Well, but it bugs me a little bit when people say my memoirs.
Wars?
Yeah,
that's horrible.
But people say it. Maybe it's acceptable. I don't know. But
my next memoir, I will do another one.
You are doing it.
Book two.
Yeah.
Everything I forgot to tell you in the first book.
Well, I was so that's what you said to me, and this year it came out and was a Los Angeles Times bestseller.
Thank you.
Yeah. How amazing is that?
It's actually last year, but I opened number 8 on the LA Times bestseller list.
Oh, my God.
Pretty exciting.
And you were written about everywhere. New York Times style section.
Full page. That wasn't an advertisement.
No, they did.
I had 5 pages in the London Times, their calendar.
So, okay, tell us, and you know, me and my many listeners who are sitting here with bated breath, the story. Now, how did you get this book deal?
You want to know about the book deal?
No, I want to know about the life that led up to
Okay,
Pacoima.
It's all such a big story, isn't it?
It starts in Pacoima, I know that much.
Well, it actually started on Burton Way, which is a little street...
right near where we are right
called
now.
...called the Gateway to Beverly Hills. It's like, we never even heard of that word, adjacent.
Right.
Beverly Hills. Adjacent Pacoima. Adjacent Harlem.
Right.
Right? Watts. Anyway, so I was born on Burton Way. And then I was uprooted to Pacoima. So the truth is that I started to write this book because of all the assistants and young hairdressers coming in would ask me so many questions about the 60s and the 70s because I was the first female to be in this field, acknowledged. I mean, even Sally Hershberger said to a friend of hers, which is a mutual friend of mine, who said to me, Carrie White started all of this, don't you? Mm. And that was really sweet because I really hadn't had conversation or much with Sally. And so I love her and think she's a superstar. I mean, she is. And so that was very flattering that she was acknowledging me for being a trailblazer here in this field.
Yeah.
And even though clearly I was, I am. There wasn't any women, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so people would ask me questions, hairdressers, and I would talk about, you know, starting, how I started and my first salon. And then more than that, they would start asking me about the town and they started... So it was just all a big conversation about the times that they were so interested in, the young kids that are 20 today. And, now they're 40 because when I started writing this book was 20 years ago. But anyway, those kids were even asking me. Now, even the young kids now are some of the biggest fans I have for Uppercut, for my book, because they all wish they were born in this particular era and time. We have a lot more hair advantages today from extensions and styling tools and products. And there's so many fantastic women in this field now. And it's a whole different world. And there wasn't such such a thing as like, red carpet hair. And you right. just, that was your client. And she was up for an Oscar. Hi, Faye Dunaway. I'll meet you at the hotel. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right, right.
And which there's a picture of her giving me a big kiss the night she won the award for Bonnie and Clyde. That was my hairdo. But they were just our clients. We didn't even think right. like the big business that it is now.
Right, right.
And you would really even get excited to see Elizabeth Taylor coming to an event because it was her jewelry, it was her clothes, what was she going to wear?
Right.
It wasn't loaned by, borrowed by, you right. wear, you have five dresses, we're trending this, or
right,
how
right.
it is today. It's
yeah.
such a huge marketing, it's all a big damn commercial.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
back up. So everybody was asking me, and I thought, I'm so tired of telling the same story that
right.
I'm going to write a book. So that was in my head. And of course, this is after I got sober.
Mm-hmm.
I would think about writing a book before, but of course I could never find a pencil or a piece of paper.
Right. Let alone, what's a computer?
Life was talking. There weren't computers.
Right.
Even when I started writing, I wrote Uppercut all in Stenopad. I think you helped me transfer some of it.
There was a computer involved. I remember
there was a computer finally in the 90s.
Yeah,
in the 90s, I got a computer. But
yeah.
anyway. Okay, so here's the premise. I started writing this book to talk to all the hairdressers that were coming into this field that are my age now that I was when I was first started, because I had my first salon right out of beauty school.
Mm-hmm.
Just by that was there was, it was fearless to
mm-hmm.
get a business. It wasn't even a thought. I just really wanted to control my environment.
I think.
Probably my, you know, the subtext of my story is certainly alcoholism.
Right.
Anyway, and then people would say, well, who did you work for before that? And so then I'd back up, and well, how did you get into this business?
Right.
Then I would back up Hollywood High, you know,
right.
ask someone asking me to model for them. Well, how'd you meet that guy? And then I would back up to junior high when I was in a foster home, and he was a friend of the foster parents. And,
right.
and then, well, how'd you end up there? And then,
it
all goes back to Born on Burton Way.
Right.
And then it's a huge story that I did not feel that ambitious about when I first began the journey of writing. I was just going to start it with my first salon. Hi, is
right.
this the budget shop? Depends on your budget, lady, because my first salon was a cheap little budget shop on Brighton Way, which is now Armani Emporio.
Well, and it became not a cheap little budget shop.
Oh my God, no. No.
So I would love to, let's go to the story, focusing on addiction and then getting into the hair as well.
All right. I was 5 years old when my father had already been gone and I started mixing drinks for my mother and her boyfriends.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't complicated. It was bourbon and 7-Up.
Mm-hmm.
It was warm. It was sweet. It was my connection to my mother. I would sip that drink if I would fill it too full to carry it over on a little tray to my mother and her boyfriends. And that's how my first page begins.
Mm.
And so when I tasted that bourbon and 7-Up and that it was felt so good and warm and I knew, oh, I get it.
It smelled like mom.
It smelled like mom. It was like, you know, you get the. It just burned enough like a good chili pepper, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, right.
So then I started mixing a drink for myself, literally at 6 years old.
Wow.
By the time I was 7, I was always thinking about that bourbon, making
mm-hmm.
that little drink. And then one time I skip past my mother's desk. She worked at home. She was an artist, and there was a cup of coffee on her desk, and I sipped that, and it was all laced with bourbon.
Mm.
And then I went, oh, I get it. You put it in everything.
Right. Wow.
And that was my, again, these are important decision-making
yeah.
moments of my life
yeah.
that were based and being led by alcohol.
Right. Right.
I did not know the word alcoholism, alcoholic, anything
right.
like that.
Right.
It was, that's what it was. I do remember there was an effect
yeah.
that this had on me, that where somebody else might spit it out.
Right.
I wanted more.
Yeah.
I also know that I remember that cherry flavored cough syrup that had codeine in it, mm-hmm. and that was kind of warm and fuzzy. Mm-hmm. And then this one man married my mother, mm-hmm. picked us up from Burton Way, just when I was getting a handle on Rosewood Elementary over there, mm-hmm. and dropped us off in Pacoima. Mm-hmm. And then here I am in a completely different culture shock, but it was a huge influence on my life. And by the way, another big heart, passion, source, energy for Uppercut was I wanted to share with everybody these amazing experiences and meet all these people that influenced my life that mm-hmm. nobody could meet anymore.
Right.
Unless you met Danny Trejo doing Machete at a red right. carpet event because he was from Pacoima.
Right.
But that was the neighborhood. It was right. all Danny Trejos.
Right. Okay. Right. Right.
And so from Pacoima, here I am, this little white fluffy girl in this hardcore black and Mexican neighborhood, wondering how did they get their hair so high, and that pachuco hop looked like fun. Everybody was like in a line and spinning in circles with crinoline skirts and, okay, party.
Right.
I was a party waiting to happen.
Did they ask you to come to the dances?
Well.
No, you were like... You were just figuring it out.
I'm just figuring it
out.
You see the you're checking the lay of the land.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you get yourself a best friend. Oh, and I loved my best friend, my beautiful friend Beverly Foster, who I write about, who we would ditch school. She taught me everything, how to mm-hmm. shoplift and mm-hmm. ditch school.
All the important skills.
Oh, and how to French inhale.
Right.
Cigarettes.
Right.
Now we're entering. Cigarettes are coming yeah. into the life. My really, you know, it was yeah. after the drink, but what a partner.
Yeah.
And then she taught me how to French inhale, and people would say, doesn't that get you dizzy? I go, yeah, that's my favorite
right.
part.
Right.
I mean, it was all about additives.
Yeah.
I got it.
Did she teach you about drugs? Were drugs there then?
Drugs weren't really there yet, mm-hmm. but the older kids, so we're like 9.
Yeah.
And we have boyfriends that are 15. We're just necking and kissing and
right,
stuff
right.
like that. Meanwhile, I was being beat up and molested by the stepfather. Mm-hmm. So to stay away from home and be across the tracks with the gangs was safer than for me to go
yeah.
home. And eventually, I became like a mascot of one of these gangs. Called the Renegades, of course, and they're all like the lowriders, and mm-hmm. you know, and it was a super time. There really was a Von Dutch, and they were taking their cars to him, and he was pinstriping all the cars, and they were being lowered and shaved and French hooded lights in the front of it, and candy apple this, and you know, lowered Mercs and Chevys and
right.
Fords, you know, and then we'd go drive down through Pacoima, you know, all kind of, yeah, some were probably higher than me, but then there was another, you know, while people are remembering whatever they're studying in school or where they're going or stuff, all I know now is like, slow gin.
Right, right.
Enter new drink.
Right.
Southern Comfort, enter new drink. Add to the library.
Were you telling your mom about what was happening at home?
Oh my God, no.
Yeah.
My mother had abandoned me long
yeah.
before she really left and I ended up in a foster home.
So
I remember when she stopped kissing me goodnight and tucking me into bed because she was passed out on the couch with Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny is the one who she married and became the molester. So I was on my own. Clearly I knew I was on my own. My mm-hmm. mother was all about her boyfriends and she had no idea anything more about me. She was just, she was drunk. You could see her glazed eyes, and
yeah.
I never wanted to be like her, and I had no respect for her, and
mm-hmm.
She didn't matter.
Yeah.
She was pathetic. I knew more about this guy that she was married to than she did, and I would scream for her help when he'd start to beat me with a hairbrush, and she'd say, "He's your father." I'm like, he's
oh
not my
God.
Father. I mean, there's a story in here. I'm not going to tell you for anybody that wants to read
yeah.
it. Just for shock value. But he does a terrible, terrible thing to me that I...
More terrible than what you've said.
More terrible than what I've said.
You guys, $24.95 if you want to hear the terrible story.
Yeah, $24.95, or you can download it for like I don't know, on an ebook for...
Did you... Oh, download it. Oh, did you do the audio version?
I haven't. You know, they don't want to do audio version because it's 3% of sales.
Yeah,
it does nothing. And I just emailed my agent today and I said, is that mine? Can I do my own production of it? Everybody wants me to do an audio version.
I got the rights back for one of my books to do it because I thought I wanted to do it.
Uh-huh.
And then I went in a recording booth with a...
It's difficult.
Oh, my... It takes days and days and days. I did it for one of my really short books.
Uh-huh.
And that was enough for me. It's a huge...
Overtaking.
But you should read yours.
I should.
Yeah.
I can play all parts. Oh, Billy Grimes. He's so fun.
Okay, so...
All right, so anyway... Meanwhile, so my mother was not, she was just a ghost, a shred of a human being, poor thing, with her alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Not that I knew that at the time.
Right.
I just, she was like a lame dog to me.
Yeah.
I had nothing, no respect for her.
And you didn't connect the drinking.
She broke my heart.
Yeah.
She uprooted me for this guy out of my roots on Burton Way, took me to this place and never cared. She didn't even bring my doll. She didn't even pack my doll that meant so much to me, my Patty doll. I'm like, where's Patty? Oh, she was all this. I left her.
So, but you didn't connect what you were doing, the drinking, with her at all? You
Not at all.
Totally separate.
Oh, no. It was an escape from her.
Yeah.
It was like she had her thing and her beers. I had my beers, which I was just... Oh, that's what I was going to say about Beverly, my friend Beverly. So Beverly and I had these older boyfriends, and they would get us beer, and we would... So... I didn't drink beer at my house.
Mm-hmm.
I just had snuck the bourbon.
Yeah.
But later, I certainly drank beer with my mother. Later. But anyway, I would drink beer and smoke cigarettes with our boyfriends that were 15. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Because I was being abused and molested, I never want to do anything more than kiss.
Yeah.
Neck and make out. And I think that saved me in some weird, crazy way because the other girls were all getting pregnant.
Did Beverly get pregnant?
Beverly got pregnant, but not in elementary school.
Right.
And in junior high, her mother sent her somewhere else. To another school. What I found out, just to fast forward, is that at 21 years old, Beverly had become a prostitute to support two little girls and her heroin addiction. Because we do gravitate to each other, don't we?
Yeah.
Even in the youngest point.
Yeah.
And she picked up a rifle and blew her brains out because she couldn't do it one more day.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that? 21.
What point
she
did
was
you guys
done.
Lose touch at 12 or whatever?
Yeah. I always loved her. I never saw her again. I found a new Beverly at Hollywood High, my Roslyn, who became my best friend at Hollywood High, who is another one who... You know, there's question whether she killed herself or overdosed or whatever, but she was the one that turned me on to diet pills and, you know, and then I would maintain mine. She went really crazy with diet pills. She would take so many. They were always in
the Dexedrines.
Ooh. Dexedrine.
Okay, wait, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do that. Listeners, you don't need to worry about what we just did.
Oh.
I just didn't like it moving around.
Oh, okay.
So Dexedrine, so speed.
Yeah,
so start taking speed.
Well, this is, okay, let's scoot up here a little bit. So from Pacoima, Johnny, the stepfather, gets busted. My mother trips out. She's lost in bars and I don't know where. She's never home. I end up staying at this place that takes in lost stray cats and dogs. Kids from the neighborhood. They're not legitimate foster people, but they were like a foster home, and they would take in all the kids. The husband ran the local junkyard, and he was always getting stray kids, and she was just a figure that took in stray kids, and that's where I lived for the next 3 years. And
so from ages when to when?
From, let's see, about 12 to... Well, let's see, on my 13th birthday, I was definitely living with her until almost 16 when my mother came back picked me up, came there, found me there, and brought me back to Hollywood High and said, I have a place and we're leaving and you're coming away. And there was no fight for me to do, and I was furious that she was taking me. Now I was like locked into Pacoima.
Right, right.
But there's some little fragment of me knew that, you know, I wasn't getting pregnant like all my friends that were quitting school, and I really didn't want to end up in a dead-end street.
Yeah.
Where a lot of, you know, you could see all the mess that was going on. I'm sure there was pot going on. There weren't, like, really didn't hear about guns. There were a lot of knives and street fights and stuff like
right.
that. And I was going to say, this is another thing that's key to my life for protecting and serving drugs and alcohol, that's for sure. When I was 10 at one of these parties, I was like 10 or 11, and I used to live with these foster people off and on because my mother would be gone and I would stay with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were cool. They let me go to these places anyway. So I was at this party and it got busted.
Mm-hmm.
By the cops came in, noise or whatever that it mm-hmm. was, unruly kids and stuff. And when the police came to the back room where I was already out of hand. And the kid said, get her in the back room. Like, I was already disturbing the party.
Right, right, right.
At 10, you
right.
know what I mean?
Drunk.
Drunk, because
yeah.
I was drunk. They said, somebody put her away. She
yeah.
can't have any more,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, what? You know. And so when the cops came in and they said, how old are you? And I said, I'm fine. How are you?
Right.
They said, wrong answer. You're coming with us. They arrested somebody else outside that was fighting, and then they took me, and then the foster people came and picked me up. But that's when I got the message, uh-oh, you better be careful.
Yeah, they could be so out of control.
They could take your...
Away.
They could take it away from you.
Yeah.
What could they take away from me? My alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was something that I thought, I am never going to get arrested again. And I wasn't.
Never.
Uh-uh. And believe me, that takes a lot of cleverness. So I believe alcoholics are not stupid. They're just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It takes a lot before you decide to get sober,
yeah.
you know, or want to, or have that glimmer of hope that you could.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. You know, we were talking about how the perception about cigarette smoking has
yeah.
changed. So I think the perception of addiction has changed so
oh
much
my gosh.
Since I've been sober.
Since you've been sober. My mother, by the way, died in County General Hospital at 54 years old. That's pretty young when I
yeah.
look at people that are just 42 today.
Yeah.
They look like they're
yeah,
kids.
Yeah. yeah.
And my mother was 54. She looked 154. She died in County General Hospital, and they wrote on her death certificate pneumonia.
Yeah.
And I always say, you know, my mother didn't have the fortunate life to see her favorite movie star coming out of their 19th rehab like we get to see.
Yeah.
So the good news is the conversation is up.
Well, and the purpose of after party chat and all the stuff that I'm doing is to get the conversation about recovery up.
Yeah.
To match
not just
all the conversations
death.
About the addiction.
Yeah. yeah, just the death. They just show the train wrecks. Nobody shows the wellness.
Yeah.
I have 29 years of sobriety. That is ridiculous. I didn't think I could stay sober 29 seconds.
Well, so, okay, so then just you graduate from high school.
Graduate from high school. I don't know how, because I was doing diet pills, drinking, working at Hollywood Paramount, which is El Capitan now, and, you know, still staying up late, sneaking out the window. I had a boyfriend, 20.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, loved him. Danny's in the book. You love him.
And then
I was going to be an actress, and all my best friends were Barbara Parkins, Stephanie Powers, whose name was Taffy Paul. Barbara Parkins was Barbara Parkins. But everybody at Hollywood...
Barbara Parkins is?
Oh, Peyton Place. You Google her.
Okay, but Stephanie Powers, I don't know who she
okay,
is.
Okay, so you know, heart to heart, you know who Stephanie is. But she was also girl from Uncle, and she was starting to get movies. Let's see, there's a famous B-model, a B-movie star. She prides herself with being a beast movie star. Her name is Carol Wells. And there were a lot of activities going on.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Evans was ahead of me. She had just left, and she was getting famous with John Derrick that she was involved with, mm-hmm. who married Bo Derrick, mm-hmm. you know, after mm-hmm. he upgrades, mm-hmm. you know, those guys do. Anyway, and so you just fall into the line. I thought I always wanted to be an actress. I loved Shakespeare. I used to, like, lose myself, even at Pacoima, in theater. Mm-hmm. I always had, and my grandmother and my mother, they were in Babes in Toyland. I come from a theatrical mm-hmm. background, even mm-hmm. though they ended up in art and all that. And my grandmother was in vaudeville, and crazy. My grandfather was a magician and a xylophone. You know, so, you know,
being the blood.
The ham bone. There's a lot of ham bone runs around here. So the idea that I was at Hollywood High and to say I'm going to be an actress was automatic. But then how was I going to support myself?
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea what I was going to do or go to college. I always make a joke about, you know, when everybody said, what college are you going to go into? I'm like, well, go wherever you go. Where are you going? They're like, well, what'd you get on your GPA? Well, I don't think I took GPA. What is GPA? I mean, I never heard the word academic.
Right.
I was an art and drama major.
Right.
That was
right.
it.
Education was not a priority.
I was across the street at the Pancake House melting diet pills with those big coffee pots. So what are you kidding? I don't know what you're talking about. I left algebra because they wouldn't tell me what the X and the Y was. You know, it's like, I'm sorry. Do I need to take typing? That looks so confusing. And nobody even was talking about dyslexic or ADD,
right.
which is definitely in my chemical DNA.
Yeah.
So somebody came through, Billy Grimes, who I just can't wait for everybody to meet in Uppercut. He's just such an instrumental character in my life. It's bizarre that one person can introduce you to a career, your best friend, I mean a career that saves your life. I don't just mean like here's this tapestry, let's do that. No, like a huge thing that changes your life and takes you all over the world and introduces you to everybody.
Okay, so what happened? So what did he do?
So he asked me to model for him. He was going to beauty school because he had met this guy, Richard Alcala, who Robert Towne had wrote Shampoo in.
Spoiler alert, this is the man you married.
10 years later,
okay,
I marry this guy.
Okay.
So Billy introduces me to the love of my life, hairdressing, and my best friend, Aloma, who not only is my best friend, I name a child after. She is the person that saves my life by taking me to a 12-step program and getting me into the recovery house, the friendly house.
Well, and she's the most awesome lady around.
And she's the most awesome lady. And she was a supermodel, you know, before that was a title for Gus Tassel and James Galanos. And, you know, she's a photographer now. But anyway, Aloma and I are the only people that are alive that are in my book left because of recovery, because we got sober. You know, everybody else is dead that I talk about.
Yeah.
Including getting high with Jimi Hendrix at John Lennon's house.
Okay, wait, you're skipping ahead. So you model and you meet all these key people.
I go into the beauty school and I go like, oh my God, what's going in here?
Yeah.
I am an art major. This is a perfect way that I can support myself as an actress. I could even book out for auditions. Oh, this will be perfect.
Yeah.
Then I put myself through beauty school working at Bob's Big Boy.
In the valley.
Back to the valley.
Burgers.
Back to, I'm staying with the foster parents.
Okay.
So I have a place to stay, and that doesn't cost me. I'm going to beauty school and working a shift at night.
Wow.
I have my diet pills.
Yes, you don't need food.
I have my secret weapon.
You don't need food.
I eat a little food, but, you know, and then it spins out. And then there's that whole other big story that when there's a day off, I go party with the party people because we find each other.
Yeah.
Party girl.
Yeah.
And so one of the guys that I'm having the most fun with, who's really a terrific hairdresser, we're kind of like a little team, he asked me to marry him.
Yeah.
I say, sure, why not? I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm having a midlife crisis. I'm 17.
Married him at 17?
Yeah, I was 17. I was 17. I was 17. I wasn't 18 yet when I graduated.
He was a top-notch hairdresser already.
No.
Oh,
this is the kid in beauty school. I'm in beauty school.
Okay.
Don't forget, I had three husbands.
Oh, yeah. I do forget.
Yeah. This guy happens to be... Oh, then I run into another girl I went to Pacoima Junior High with. She marries the the beauty school teacher, the instructor.
Yeah.
And she follows me around and wants me to participate. They're starting a little business called Sebastian. I say, oh, I'm too busy. You want some champagne?
Right.
Yeah.
Could have been, okay.
She's still my pal.
Yeah.
Sebastian, Jerry Cosenza.
Wow.
And John Cosenza. Yeah, we're still really good friends. Anyway, so Jordan ends up, I move in with him. He's living at his parents' house. We have our own little cottage in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think he's like my friend and stuff that I happen to sleep with. And, okay, I'm going to get married. It's nice. They got a swimming pool. I'm exhausted.
So it wasn't true love.
Wasn't true love, but it was fun.
Bad. Okay.
I see, in my book, I explain what happens with Danny and I, and I'm done. I think I'm never going to be in love again after Danny breaks my heart in high school. That's it. My heart. I'm done.
Yeah.
So who cares?
Yeah,
Jordan, hey, you're a good hairdresser. Yeah, let's get married.
And a pool.
And you got a swimming pool in Reseda. Oh, well, that's lovely. I don't really like the valley, but okay.
Yeah.
What the hell? And then he doesn't come home one night. We're married about 3 months. He calls me. He's at this hotel on Hollywood Boulevard. Could I come pick him up? Really? He finally decided to call me? Okay, great. Where are you? Well, and I'm not with a girl. I'm with a guy. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'll pick you up, but I don't really want to work with this.
Yeah.
And so, okay, he's gay.
Yeah.
Give me back my eyelash curler. This is over. We annul our marriage, and then I find out I'm pregnant because he's not all that gay for 5 minutes.
Right, right, right. You're so hot that even though he's gay, apparently.
Yeah. Now, I don't know I'm pregnant. We get this annulled. In the meantime, from my annulment, I do one of my customers at beauty school keeps asking me to pose for her husband. He's a Playboy photographer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I pose for him. I get picked.
Yeah.
I'm Miss July. I'm going to be Miss July. Well, I didn't know I was pregnant.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you were pregnant.
No.
I just saw that photo.
Yeah, but my body didn't know I was pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, I don't think the baby was the size of a kernel of corn. So that was just, all that happened. He doesn't come home. He's with a guy. I say, okay, let's have this annulled. I'm going to need a job. So then I go back to that lady that keeps asking me to model. And I say, how much does that pay?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And then after that, I get it. And then a month later, I find out, oh, I'm having a baby.
Right.
Whoa. No, it's not like I'm pregnant in Playboy. I mean.
No, I know. I just thought you, Okay.
I mean, I guess I was, but it's
technically, but
not really.
Yeah.
And so I have a moment of clarity, and I know I'm an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly. Mm-hmm. Now am I 18? I'm 18.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm an alcoholic. I'm pregnant. I give this child for adoption because I wanted her to have a better chance than I did. I know I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to have a child. I'm recreating the scene of the crime. I'm going to be the divorced woman with the only child, like my mother. And I thought, this is no start for anybody. It wasn't great for me. It's not. Why would it be great? I don't know where I'm going. I know what's my primary purpose, and that's to drink and do diet pills. I guess I was still whatever that was. So. That's a closed case. Done. Now, the guy that's nice to me the last month of my pregnancy, he's like, well, are you going to say thank you and marry me or not? And I go like, oh, I'm totally intimidated. He's very, like, controlling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fear-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm supposed to.
So you say yes.
I say, yeah, now can we have a drink?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Will there be champagne?
Right.
You know. Meanwhile, we get married at the little brown church, and the ring doesn't even fit on my finger. That should have been the first clue.
Yeah, that is never, a sign. Aren't you supposed to know these things ahead of time?
Oh, I had no idea. I mean, he just had me by the nape of my neck. We're getting married. I had tried to leave him before we got married. And, of course, I didn't have the guts to move until I had two children from him. Two children. So here I am now. I'm like 22. I've had three children and second husband and divorced.
Hmm.
I then kind of run around wildly in this town. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I'd been hanging on Jim Morrison's ankle at the Whiskey A Go-Go with a Black Russian in my hand.
What does that mean, hanging on Jim Morrison's ankle? Because, so, like, they were the doors came around.
Literally holding on to his ankle on stage.
Just because...
Because his foot was there, and I was there dancing, and he was cute, and I'd hold on to him, probably for balance, so I wouldn't fall down.
Right.
I was drunk.
Right.
And I have a Black Rush. Everybody was drunk. Everybody was on tilt. It was like, da-da-da-da-da-da. Everything was on tilt.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I had gotten a beauty salon when I was married to my second husband, mm-hmm. and I was doing quite well. I was getting write-ups in Glamour Magazine, Mademoiselle. They were doing stories. I was so popular by the time I was 21.
Wow.
I was called, I got a telegram to tell the truth, will the real Carrie White please stand up?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Selma Dunn. Me too, as a kid. Can you imagine?
Did you do it?
Yes. Nobody guessed me. Did I do it? And then nobody can believe this when I tell like kids coming in. So when I'm doing hair, I've got all these fancy ladies that's a whole big story how that unfolds with the hair. We don't need that. But as that unfolds, I'm doing all these fancy ladies and try to wrap around. There's no internet.
Yeah.
There's no...
I remember that.
We don't know any global... Global wasn't even a word in our... Anyway. And so I'd be pulling on Mrs. Bloomingdale's shirt and say, what's it like in Paris? Because they're all like, oh, I'm going to Paris. Oh, I'm going to New York. Oh, I'm going to Afghanistan. I had never been anywhere. I was felt lucky to get back to the other side of the valley.
Right.
Let alone, what are the windows like in Chanel? I mean, I didn't even know Chanel wasn't just a perfume number 5. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
As opposed to kids today, they got like Gucci bags. They're 9.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everything.
Yeah.
We're bombarded with labels.
Yeah.
So then she hears I'm going to New York to tell the truth, mm-hmm. and she gets me hooked up. I have my first credit card, my Diners Club, because her husband started Diners Club.
Betsy Bloomingdale.
Yeah, Alfred Bloomingdale.
Oh, that's
they
so
give
nice.
Me a Diners Club.
Now, did they pay the bill?
Well, that's what I thought it was all free. I didn't know how it worked. So I'm divorced. I'm going to tell the truth. I take this cute Italian race car driver that I have the biggest crush on. I tell him, like,
I'm going.
Are you busy this weekend? I got a place on the Americas Avenue, and I don't even, you know, I had done a little bit of traveling. I think I'd already been to London and Paris and India through hairdressing. I've been taken all over the world already by a lot of people, but New York was pretty revolutionary to go on a television show.
Yeah.
So he says, yeah. So he comes with me, we party, and then he comes into my room one night while we're there, and he says, I have this special thing for you, a little brown bottle. And he tells me, I go, $50 and you put it up here, what? And it was cocaine. It was my first experience with cocaine. So he goes in takes a shower, and he's going to come back out. We're going to, like, drink and do coke, I guess.
Yeah.
But while he was in the shower,
I snorted it off.
The whole little bottle was so
tiny.
Tiny. I had no idea. Well, he was furious. I thought, God, what's he so upset about? Go get some more.
Right.
And,
But you felt pretty good.
I felt very good. And then later I got like why he was so excited.
Yeah.
When you run out, you really...
Oh, yeah. Problem.
You learn to understand you cannot run out.
No.
Oh, dear God.
No.
We call it carpet farming, don't we?
You mean when you're
digging
the cat hair?
Digging
ashes.
Oh, jeez. So gross. The life is so grimy. Anyway, so while that we work that all out, and he says, he's looking at the paper one day, and we're in New York, and he says, look at this. This looks like fun. You still have that card? I'm like, of course. He says, why don't we go to Puerto Rico? I'm like, I don't know. Just sign this thing. It's magic. So we go to Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
We go to San Juan. I get arrested for indecent exposure.
You were naked?
Well, I wasn't naked, but it seems I was in a bathing suit in the wrong area of town or something. They're very Catholic or conservative or I don't know what.
Okay. But, so getting arrested in San Juan's no joke.
He had to bail me out of jail.
Yeah.
And in a paddy wagon and all that. And he comes and gets me.
Did he like, bail you out with the diners?
Again, he's like, do you have that card? Where's that card? So we get that card. So I get back and sure enough, Betsy Bloomingdale wants her card back.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was my first credit card experience. But so now I'm introduced to cocaine.
Yeah.
To my menu. And it kind of gets dropped. I go back to, you know, okay. I don't know, I like it. But then now it's a lot of disco dancing and a lot of poppers.
Oh
my God, the most fun ever.
Really?
Then you're in love with everybody.
But for like 5 seconds.
It's enough.
Yeah, okay.
Long enough.
Okay. Yeah, my only association is like gay men like use them during sex. Like,
yeah.
I miss those.
Oh, you miss it. They were so popular, those poppers. What's the other name for them? What are they called?
You're asking someone who
didn't really do them. I forget. Poppers, but there's... Oh, geez. I think it starts with an A. I have to look that up. So these things, they're very popular, and these little gauzy yellow... I had two friends they bought a whole box of them. They put them in a closet, and then they closed the closet door with all the poppers on the floor, and they jumped on them in the closet. So they would be in a very small condensed area with the flooding of this.
Oh my God!
With this fuse.
Oh, because it was all air. It all. It,
yeah,
you popped it in
air. Yeah. It wasn't liquid. Amyl nitrate.
Thank you.
That's what it was.
Okay.
And then I used to like pass out with them. I'd wake up and I'd have one of those yellow gauze things come out of my nose. Thousands of them in the bed. And
right.
Who was I with? I don't know. Somebody from the Whiskey A Go Go. I think he was the lead singer of, what was that group? Oh, yeah, Steppenwolf. I mean, and that's true.
Right. I don't doubt it.
Nicholas.
I don't doubt it.
Nick Nicholas. I had to go to Tower Records to look it up and see what his name was, because I never remember that weekend. Anyway, oh gosh.
This is the era when you were on the roller skates?
Getting close.
So you have a salon and all these celebrities are coming to you. And this
celebrities
is
packed in, because there weren't that many fancy hairdressers. Salons, talented hairdressing.
Yeah.
You know, Jose Bear wasn't here yet.
And so this was like, is this when you did Elvis's hair?
That was a little later on. That's when I married Richard.
So
I
you
did
married
Elvis.
Richard.
I married Mr. Shampoo. By the way, if you look at the movie, you will see everybody that worked for Richard are the actual names used in the film Shampoo.
Okay.
Warren calls Mary the maid, and Molly is the receptionist, and everybody wants to claim that their Shampoo was after them. It's such a fallacy. It was a combination of my husband, Richard Alcala, and Gene Chakove, who he and I were technical advisors on that film, doing the hair. All those people were my clients. Lee Grant was my client. Goldie Hawn was my client. Julie Christie was my client. I cut Warren Beatty's hair for 10 years. And even Robert Town was my client.
Did you have sex with Warren Beatty? Doesn't every woman have to have sex with
Warren
Beatty?
It's kind of my claim to fame. I did not.
It's impressive.
It's impressive, isn't it?
Oh, but remember,
I was married to one of his good friends, Richard Alcala. You know.
Okay, wait. I don't know. I just remember this, so I hope it's okay to bring it up. Didn't you date Jack Nicholson as like,
I
a
did.
Teenager?
He was my second boyfriend.
That's so crazy.
It's cute. He lived with two other guys on Fountain Avenue.
Yes.
And Jack, my mother say, What are you doing with him? Isn't he an older guy? I said, yeah, but Mom, he sounds just like Henry Fonda. Jack, he with that big smile, yeah. He does remember me. We're still friends. The last I saw him was at a very big party he gave for Bucket List. And he's a very loyal, beautiful guy. I love Jack. Jack.
So, okay, so.
I always tell Jennifer Nicholson, I could have been your mother.
Oh, that's
anyway, she laughs. She likes that. We're friends.
So then, okay, marry Richard.
Marry Richard, have two kids, think he'll never complain about my drugs and alcohol because he smokes so much pot, he drinks so much alcohol, he's such a cool guy. Cocaine is back into the picture, and there's no limits.
Yeah.
There's no red lights. Everything's cool. Everything's groovy. Do whatever you want. Come to bed when you want. Do whatever you want. But eventually, it got in the way. Yeah. And the bigger my career got, the bigger my disease got. And I like to never forget that when I was called to do a second television special for Peggy Fleming, an ice skating gold medalist, that Bob Banner asked me that there was a very big privilege for all of us to get to go to Russia. And while he was talking, my first thought was, all that vodka and no cocaine, I will expose my alcoholism. I cannot go. So when he finished talking, I said, oh, geez, Bob, those dates don't work for me. Wow. I can't go.
Yeah.
And I lost the incredible experience of going to Russia in the 70s.
Yeah. So it progressed. And then what happened?
Well, Richard and I started fighting. We were in this, you know, we worked together. We both came together and put a salon together on Burton Way, back on Burton Way.
Yeah.
And yes, I was having a ball, you know, for so many years with my spandex pants and roller skates, doing hair, flipping through the salon. And I was just his, he was 10 years older than me, so he'd always introduce me as his lovely bride, his beautiful young bride. And I was like in charge, but I wasn't in charge. My alcoholism was in charge.
Right.
I call my disease Audrey, like that flower in the shop of horrors.
Right.
And Audrey was on a mission, feed me more bodies, you know, and there just was never enough for her, never enough cocaine. Richard was starting to look pathetic. He wasn't making enough money to support my habit. I was supporting everything, the house on the hill, the, you know, the kids, the whatever that was going on. And I just started getting as annoyed with him, and he started looking as pathetic as my mother did. My disease was getting so big and nasty and rude, and it was hateful, and I had to break away from him. He was just really cramping my style.
Right.
So horrible. And my kids were such collateral damage of this marriage that had gone awry through drugs and alcohol, because he was really such a great guy, and you know, and I loved him so much, and he loved me so much. You know, nobody loved me like Richard loved me. And, you know, I don't know. Things started interfering. I mean, he wasn't coming up to his end, truly. He couldn't work as much as he was, not being a ladies' man, being the Romeo on the things. I was starting to get jealous. I caught him with his hand down somebody's smock one day, and that I was just waiting to catch him so I could say, that does it, and justify my getting out of there. I was looking for it.
Right.
I was glad that he did that, though I made it like such an injustice and a horrible thing. And I took my two little kids from him. And my other two went to Bucky, that I had always fought against him taking those kids. He always wanted to take those kids from me. And I was just running around, and I was getting broker and broker. I was almost going to lose the salon and my house on the hill on Mulholland. Finally, we separated. We sold that house. I met somebody who wrote on a mirror, I love you, in cocaine. And I went, oh, I guess I love you too. It just happened that it was a woman.
Oh, I forgot about this part. Okay.
I mean, and then she introduced me to heroin. And so it was like, oh, let's see. I haven't tried those two things.
Right.
And that's what it was about for me. It was like, okay, you know, like I'm on some big adventure. I was on a downhill racer is what I was on. And so I left my salon one time. She used to send her assistant in with envelopes of cash for me to leave.
To just bribe you to leave?
To bribe me to leave. $10,000 cash in an envelope one day. Her assistant came by with a note that says, do you really have to work today?
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's like, I don't think I was making that a year.
What,
I don't even
what,
know.
She was like independently wealthy?
Independently wealthy.
Yeah.
And so finally one day.
You were like, no, I don't
I was so exhausted and out of ideas.
Yeah.
And more worried not for my losing my house or losing the salon, but keeping the liquor store credit open. Here's somebody that just wanted me to sit home and
do heroin.
Drink Cristal champagne.
Right.
And whatever I wanted. Well, she was doing heroin. I wasn't doing heroin. And buy me all the Coke I wanted. Are you kidding?
Right.
I've been working since I'm 9 years old. I was exhausted. I've been having, like I say, midlife crisis since I was like 17.
Right.
So I thought, oh, God, lucky me. I never, never wanted to give up the House of Carrie. You know, my salon was one place. I could always get a dollar. I always had respect. I mean, customers were leaving me left and right. They couldn't watch the destruction. I'd be up for days. I'd come in with hats and sunglasses and didn't brush my hair. You know, just reeking of cigarettes, Sherman's, Gauloises, Jeton, a stinky, stinky poo-poo, you know.
And then...
Everything that I thought I ever wanted, all the money and all the drugs, ran out. Even with that, we went through $1 million the first year. That ran out. That money ran out. That source of her money ran out. It could not feed the disease as it grows, as it progresses. Neither hers nor mine. And we started going to hospitals. At the recommendation of her family, who was paying for me included. And I'd have friends watch my kids, and I couldn't stay longer than 2 days. I would bail out, and she would bail out, and she'd say, are you coming? Well, of course I'm coming. I'm going wherever. I need to support my disease. I want to pull my spine out of my back with my bare hands. I mean, we ended up drooling on ourselves at the Venice Methadone Clinic just to get something before we could drive to the dealer.
Wow.
You know, there was no such thing as enough to... wasn't even getting high. It was just so I wouldn't be sick, so I didn't want to die, you know. And it was terrible. I mean, there's some funny, crazy things, you know, that I write about, like filling my house with... We bought a house together in Malibu, which I ended up taking over, and she left. And
what happened to her?
She went back with her family and lived with her family, took care of her, and I don't know where she is or what happened, but it's all right. Bless, bless, peace, peace. And, you know, I don't write about her because that's her privilege and her right and her story, and not for me to talk about her. I don't talk about anybody, really. When people say, is this a tell-all book? I say, oh, yeah, I tell it on myself.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Not anybody else.
So and what was it that got you sober?
Well, eventually going through those hospitals and trying to get free, I'd have a glimpse of some kind of sanity of how crazy we were living. You know, and then the pain of seeing my children's eyes and their disappointment and tragedy that was going on in this house, and the hatred that she didn't like them and she wanted them to be quiet and she wasn't feeling well all the time, and I was scared for my kids, I was scared from her, and sick on my own, and how was I going to survive? You know, they say you put the oxygen on yourself first and then your kids. I mean, I knew I had to survive. So I'd go to the dealer first before I could think in my day, every day, and end up in a fetal position on the dealer's doorsteps waiting for them to answer the door just to get a gravel of who knows what to smoke the heroin. I'm lucky I never stuck needles in my arms, me particularly, because I know that I would have overdosed for sure because it wouldn't have been enough, you know.
And so what? So what did it?
So finally, after at the sixth hospital, two things occurred. One, we were separated.
Mm-hmm.
Finally,
mm-hmm.
It's real hard to two people. You know, your disease is connected to another person.
Yeah.
It's beyond a trigger.
And you can also always there's that. You can also say like, oh, they're so much worse than me. I don't even really have a problem.
Well, I don't know about that part. I don't know. I didn't think who's worse or who's not, but I always thought I couldn't survive if she was getting high. I wanted to get high too, you know. And I knew that my getting sober wasn't making her want to get sober. But finally, I saw that my freedom depended on my sobriety to get away from her to get away from the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't get away from her, I would never get away from the drugs. So
yeah.
I knew I had. So when they decided, it wasn't even my idea, when they decided to separate us, I thought, maybe I have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I have a chance to live. I knew I was going to die.
So this was kind of, there weren't rehabs? It was just hospitals?
It was just hospitals,
yeah.
And which don't even exist anymore. One is Century City Hospital twice, Beverly Glen Hospital. I don't think that exists anymore.
Wasn't that like...
I didn't go to Thalians. I went to Beverly Glen a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Century City a couple of times.
And you would stay. So the, at one
just
point,
a short period.
Okay.
4 days, and
okay.
then the whatever start getting real, and
yeah.
then get sick, and you know I smuggled smack into the hospital once, and the nurse caught me, and I told her I was going to call the police if she didn't give me back my property.
Yeah, that worked.
She said, "Why don't you call the police and tell them I have your hair on?" You know, no, that did not work.
So,
and then you go like, oh, that sounds crazy when you hear her say it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, oh, sorry,
right.
sorry. You know, and I was on her money, you know, still, or her family was paying for these hospitals. So the other thing that worked, we got separated, and I borrowed money from my second husband
mm-hmm.
to watch my kids for 30 days, and I would pay him back, and that which I did, and that hospital was the one that worked, the one I paid for.
Interesting.
And that I was separated from my partner in drugs and alcohol was the only thing, and I slowly started hearing and being touched by. You know, people that were in the 12-step program that were sober, that were techs, that were not doctors and not
mm-hmm.
people telling of authority telling me, you know, what you're doing isn't a good idea, but somebody that did it like I did, like the girl that helped me, Bridget, who I write about, who, you know, said, oh, you're complaining? Try kicking in jail. And I thought, oh, that doesn't sound good. A metal cot and a sheet.
Mm-mm.
You know, I'm in fancy Coldwater Canyon Hospital. It's not as fancy as these promises and
pills. They make you wish you were on drugs practically.
Oh, I mean, I've spoken at some of those places. They got the frette sheets and
yeah.
the strawberries bigger than your head for break period, you know, have a strawberry. Yeah. Anyway, my gosh, it's so exhausting just talking.
I know. So that was 29 years ago.
29 years ago. So I'm waiting for a ride. I used in between that ride to take me to a recovery house. I never heard of a recovery house. I had to go into sober living. It was supposed to be such a privilege, and it's so exhausting. My agent told me my story is the worst substance abuse story she has ever come across. And she was Hunter S. Thompson's agent.
Wow.
I said, oh, thank you. You mean I drank more than Hunter S. Thompson?
I guess
no,
that's what...
That is a fact.
No, it's definitely...
It is so grueling, the bottom. And my next book, you know, and I didn't even talk about the last 29 years.
I know.
Which will be book two.
Isn't that always what? Oh, in the book you do.
I talk about going through the recovery house, the adventures in sobriety, just you know, getting that little embryo stage and the prenatal and the birth into sobriety.
Yeah.
And then I pretty much cut to today, and here I am as we sit in my
salon
with my name back on the door, respected, with you know, have had everybody A-list clients, everybody coming back who's been in this place from, you know, I don't know, Jason Patrick to Sandra
Bullock
and Amber Valletta, and you know, I mean, superstars and Lori Rodkin, and you know, just I don't even know, I can't even, but that will be book two, will be about writing a book.
Yeah.
That deal. And because that's what I've done my whole sobriety, was the process of writing the book and not writing the book. You know, I'd be dancing in Saint-Tropez and people say, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I'm writing a book. Like, no, you're not. You're dancing in Saint-Tropez.
But your life has been so fabulous. Ever since I've known you, you were going to Saint-Tropez to go to like...
And Australia.
Naomi Campbell's birthday party or something.
Yeah.
And then recently when we were just talking about this fabulous party that we just had.
Yeah.
I was on Facebook and you're like, oh, I'm just coming back from the U.S. Open.
Where oh, yeah. U.S. Open.
Yeah, yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I could have pulled Rafael Nadal's t-shirt. Yeah, it's been a charmed, lucky life. I'm kind of like, Mrs. Magoo. I walk off a building and there's a plank underneath me that saves me, and then I make a left and then somebody scoops me up here.
But
it's been magical.
The thing is, I don't know that you know what a crucial part of my coming to love recovery you played.
Aww.
Because it was like, I was brand new. I was like the embryo with like the eyes barely blinking open, and you sort of, I felt very like scooped under your wing, and you had me speak at a meeting that was like really big, and you like did my hair for it.
Yes.
And then, I had Aloma coming up and telling me, I was like adorable, and I'm just like, and it was such that I'm sure I would have stayed sober and who knows, but it was to feel so enveloped by someone who was so involved and so in the middle and so joyful.
And I'm still
like
I'm
that.
Still involved.
I know.
I'm still joyful because I'm still sober.
Yeah.
And I'm still sober because I'm still involved.
Yeah.
It's that's how it is. Well, you see, the bottom line of my sobriety, I was such a wreck when I got here, just a thread of a human being. And finally, when I started thawing out a little bit and I could blink and all these people and everything, and there was so much love wrapped around me, that's why we give back. That's how we say thank you, is we wrap around the other people. But somewhere, early on, I got like, well, I didn't come here to have a bad time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like been the theme of my life, though it went bad. But I saw you can have fun for real. You can love for real. You can be here for real. You can make decisions for real. You can be as loud and laugh for real and not have to cover up because you don't want to get busted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you can be silly for real. And you can go on trips and you can really feel. And, everything that I thought like one wouldn't want in life. It's not that I'm afraid of my feelings. I was just afraid of my bad feelings. I don't mind my good feelings.
Right. And the amazing discovery in recovery is that the bad feelings, once you actually don't do everything to avoid them, but just feel them, they're not that bad.
Not only are they not that bad, I don't know about you, but I had no idea that everything had a beginning, middle, and an end.
Yeah, no.
I thought it was like one long day,
Well, yeah. No, I thought if you were depressed, you should stay depressed for like a year.
Ever.
A year or two.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know. So it was like I learned so much, and I'd hear people say things that were paradigm shifts to a new vault of light. And it was one time this guy said, you can have your excuses or you can have a life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what? I have the best excuses in the world.
Right.
What? Oh, I'm missing life. You're right. That was my excuses why I missed the party. My excuses why I missed work. It's my excuses why I wasn't there for my kids. It's my excuses
why you were doing drugs.
Why I missed a life.
Yeah. Well, you said one of those paradigm shifting things once in a meeting that I still remember.
Oh,
you've said a couple of things. One I quote you on all the time, which is, this is not really recovery, although it sort of is. It's all relationships are successful. Some are just shorter than others.
Exactly.
Even the, one night fling. Okay. Successful.
Yes.
But one thing you said once in a meeting, it was, I'm gonna butcher it. And it, to you, I think it was just an off the cuff thing. So I don't even think it's one of your great lines. It's something about how, there. It's like about weather and wearing the right thing.
Oh, yeah. There's no bad weather. There's just inappropriate dress.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is like, there are no big deals. But say
in
a very careful
way. Take responsibility for your complaining.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so cold. Well, dress warmer.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so hot. Well, what do you got a sweater on for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Take responsibility. Weather's going to happen. Life's going to happen.
Yeah.
We certainly prepared for our disease.
Yeah.
And clearly we lived one day at a time, no matter what, willing to go to any length.
Yeah.
We weren't late. We took directions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we got sober.
Yeah.
Those were our rules.
Yeah.
We just have to change our
priorities.
Exactly.
Well, this was awesome.
Awesome.
I mean, in
let's do it again for a week. let's have an Anna David Kerry White retreat.
This was the preview to the Kerry White interview.
I love you so much.
I love you too.
Oh, honey, you were a part of Uppercut, you know?
Yes, and how about...
I used to trade you hair to just read it. You were my writer friend.
Yes, and I remember doing that
in your
house. Your
book came out way before mine, and I never... One of the things I've learned is to never be... To deal... The jealousy is the most terrible, terrible emotion. It tells us that in our book, in our program.
But it's hard.
It tells us... No, it isn't hard.
And it's been hard for me.
Well, let me tell you, shift for it. Just celebrate that other person and know you're in line because you know them.
Yeah.
That's how I felt about you. I said, God, Anna's writing a book. Oh, Anna's book is out already. Right. I'm still working on mine. But I knew I was in line. I was still in line. And it's a contrary feeling. Instead of being, what are you, resentful for somebody did something? Celebrate them instead.
Well, and it is that I came from such a point of view of there's this very small pie with very limited pieces, rather than the actual way the world works, which is the pie is huge.
And it's huger than ever with the internet.
Yeah.
You know what my agent told me? She said, well, Carrie, she said, you know, there are more writers than readers these days.
I know.
Everybody's a bloggist.
I know.
Everybody's writing a book.
But specifically...
Who cares?
But I remember, so when I was, I want to say, like, maybe 3 years smober. And one of the other many people you got to quit smoking said, we're going to get Kerry White a brand new computer.
Oh,
so she can finish her book.
Yeah.
That was so, and now he lives in Bali.
He does, because he quit smoking. He's doing what he always wanted to do all day long. He's surfing.
Yeah.
He saved all his money and all the money he didn't spend smoking.
Yeah.
Put that in the bank, and he saved all his money working and didn't care about anything. And I think the last time I talked to him, he paid his rent for 7 years.
Oh, my God.
Which is probably 50 cents over there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what
palace,
it is. But no. Yeah, you get to make decisions. You're not peeking at your life through a smokescreen.
Yeah.
How valuable could that be?
Yeah.
And then it's like, whose life is it? But we got a long time to be dead. What's the rush?
So, but talking about all this, it makes me nostalgic for my early sobriety.
Isn't it lovely?
Because I was so fresh and new, and I just loved it so much. It kind of got harder later. It was like real easy for me in the beginning.
All you need to do, though, is dive right in back into the deep end again.
Yeah, no, and I'm into it, but it's like those days with the Chris and Sarah and Peter, and it was all just so
You get a whole bunch of new babies, though. I got, you know, a secretary at this big meeting over here, and I didn't want to do it, and... You know, I'm a firm believer that my program or my sobriety is based on this. You never know the point of the exercise.
Yeah.
And you don't. And so I didn't want to be secretary. I was like, oh, I didn't want to commit to every Sunday going there and doing and getting speakers and blah, 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 blah. Well, I got 6 new sponsees.
Yeah.
And, you know, 3 of them showed up at Book Soup the other night. It was so darling. And they just couldn't love me anymore.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of love you can't get from a family member or anybody in the whole world, this kind of enthusiasm. And they grow up and they change and then they get their sponsees and do. But if you keep resurging that new blood
through your system.
I get my energy and my enthusiasm from those new ones, and you will too.
Yeah.
When you get there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like it's
no,
a part of all the scene.
And I do love my sponsees. It's not
of course.
That it's not that I
you
don't.
Also get to see you don't want what they got. You
know,
don't want to be new again.
You know, And, but it's an amazing life. And, you know, I think we're so lucky in L.A., too, where it's such a happy place to be sober.
It's a happy place to be sober. There's so many people enthusiastic about it. And you really get posses here.
Yeah.
Whereas I think other places, it's... Well, I don't know.
I've lived in other places. It's depressing. You know, whatever.
It's pretty like...
Yeah, it's just sort of like...
Well, let's face it. We all suffer from so much personality here.
Yeah, this is an overabundance of personality.
And I wanted to say about your thing about feeling that there's not an abundance or that it's going to run out.
But that took time.
Yes, it does take time. But again, we are all designed in our own unique way to be a voice of service.
Yeah.
And I got my success when I could best serve,
yeah,
I believe,
yeah,
as opposed to another time.
Yeah.
As opposed to maybe I wouldn't have gotten my great agent and
yeah,
I wouldn't have this or I would have been that or I was, somebody would have met, you know.
Yeah.
I just believe that there's a higher power in this universe that support. If I maybe had another $100, I wouldn't be sitting here with you.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, of course you would.
Of course.
That reminds me of another thing that I remember you saying in a meeting.
What?
It's the exact same thing. I remember because this really hit me. I was new, and you talked about how when you're in traffic, you don't get upset because you think, well, what if this is the universe saving me from an accident down the street?
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways you can creatively think about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay, also you can say, if I leave earlier, I wouldn't be so uptight that I'm running so late in traffic.
Yeah, you know, that is always that, of course, chronically late. But okay, we have to stop talking.
Okay.
We do. Okay, so people, if they want to find you, you are on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter, Carrie White Hair.
There's a website.
Carrie White Hairdresser for Instagram. Carrie White.
Isn't the uppercut Carrie White? The Carrie White is a website.
TheCarrieWhite.com is Tumblr.
You're on everything. And then get the book. You can get the book on Amazon.
Just get the book.
Get the book already.
Download. See my video, too. We need to pump up those numbers.
The video hits, yeah.
Yeah, gosh, yeah.
Let's be honest. We want you to buy the book more than we want you to watch the video.
Okay,
the video's fine.
The video's fine.
But the book. Get the book.
And there's 60 rare photos.
Oh, yeah. I just was... Okay, I'm going to stop talking. But in your bathroom, it looked like those were photos from the book.
Some
of them, yeah.
And Margaret's not in the book.
But, okay, you guys, you gotta...
Well, there's one picture of me doing Anne Margaret's hair in the book.
You gotta get the book so that you can see what we're talking about. Carrie White, thank you so much.
Love you so much, Anna David.
Love you so much.
You are the party girl.